Do you like the Simply Focus podcast? Well, help Elfie and Dominic spread the word. Give the Simply Focus podcast an excellent rating on iTunes and Google Play and other platforms. Then don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
That is Simply Focus with Elfie Channing and Dominic Gooden for live enjoyment.
Are you ready for this new episode of the Simply Focus podcast? Then please welcome your hosts, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godin.
Thank you very much, Ken, and hello and welcome back, everyone. We are here in Santa Fe today, sitting in the living room with Yvonne Dolan. Hello, Yvonne.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for having us here in your house and for the lovely conversation we just had. We are so inspired already and can't wait to talk with you about Solution Focus and your Solution Focus journey today.
And you have inspired us very much, not only through your books, More Than Miracles or in German, Chaos and Wunder, for example, but also through your recipes. The brownies, for example, for therapists, or Steve's spaghetti.
When we first got a copy of the Encounters book and read it, we found your lovely article with the recipes in there. And the first thing we did was cooking those recipes. And for us, this was a very, very precious thing because I love the book in general, because this book allowed us to connect with Steve and Insu, who I haven't met, in a very different way through stories. And then having those recipes also allowed us to connect with all you guys and with Steve and Insu on a culinary experience. And this is a very great thing. So thank you very much for that.
You're very welcome. You know, it occurs to me as you say that in some ways, the solution-focused approach can be considered like a recipe in that it has some basic instructions, but each person brings what they have in their environment, what they have in their culture, what they respond to in terms of the people around them, what other people like or dislike. And so in a sense, that's a recipe too.
And I think the culinary experience was also always a very important part of solution focus, like the pizza parties. Or
yeah. Well, one of the most touching experiences I remember is one of the first European Grief Therapy Association meetings took place in Bruges, Belgium. And I remember everybody, I think it was at Luc Isebert's house, everybody sort of assembling sandwiches. You know, it was very informal. And I remember people from Sweden singing Solutions, yeah, 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 to the Beatles song. So I think there was always sort of almost a familial community sense, particularly in the early days. I think most solution-focused meetings were really about conviviality and learning from each other. I think it's still like that, but I think it's more complicated because there's all this infrastructure of meetings and things being much more official.
And that's what we love on our journey, just to meet all those people and spend time together and talk about solution focus and also do other things like being part of their everyday life and being part of our everyday life.
Drinking a hot cocoa, which you prepared for us today. Thank you so much, especially as Bibiana really appreciates that. And I think it will help her a lot to get better today.
Yeah, cocoa helps with colds, I believe. Well, there's a long tradition. The first time I visited the Milwaukee Brief Family Therapy Center and met Steve and Insu, I remember a lot went on around restaurant tables and dinner tables. Restaurant tables were never fancy. Usually they were really kind of hole-in-the-wall type Asian restaurants, often Japanese or Korean or Chinese. But Steve and his male colleagues used to have a chili cooking contest about who made the best chili. And I remember that from many years ago. And there was also a culture, and this was when Michelle Wiener Davis was there, that they used to all eat black licorice. They loved the panda black licorice. So I wasn't really part of that as an insider, but I remember visiting there and feeling very much that the Milwaukee Brief Therapy Center was sort of an ego-free zone. People were very collaborative and very interested in each other's ideas. And so I found not just the approach, but the ambiance there very inspiring. I liked that way of being with each other that they exemplified.
Yeah, and you've been part of this community for so long. You were good friends with Steve and Insu, and you wrote many books at Solution Focus. You just told us that you taught in 22 countries and did a lot for Solution Focus and a lot for us blessed that we can be here. So what fascinates you and what has fascinated you with solution focus?
Well, you know, the image that comes to mind is, and it's interesting, you know, at this time, we're all kind of struggling politically here in the United States. It's a challenging time. But I remember this quote my grandmother used to say to me, and she's quoting Eleanor Roosevelt, who was married to one of our most famous presidents here in the United States, who did a lot for other people, a lot for American citizens, a lot in terms of helping people survive financially. And Eleanor Roosevelt used to say, it was very famous for this, better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And I think in many ways, the solution-focused approach exemplifies that kind of thinking. We're always looking with this approach about what can be done. And sometimes even the smallest thing makes a difference. My grandmother used to paraphrase Eleanor Roosevelt, and she used to say, better to light even the smallest candle than curse the darkness. And I think the solution-focused approach helps us find even the smallest difference that can make a difference.
Wow. So when did you get in touch with Steve and Insoo, and how did you get into this field?
Well, I got interested in their writing back in the very early 80s, late 70s. In the early 80s, I was working in New Orleans, Louisiana, at a shelter for homeless and runaway adolescents. And the kids that I worked with had been often horrifically abused. Some of them had been sold into prostitution by their families. Many of them had been horrifically abused. And we didn't have much money or much time to help them. We had 3 weeks to work with each child, and then we had to find them some place to go. And there were very few foster homes, and some of the foster homes were more dangerous than the places they had fled. And so there was this wonderful, basically a newsletter called The Underground Railroad, edited by Steve DeShazer. And I think you're too young maybe to remember these purple mimeograph paper pages. The printing was done on a mimeograph and it was purple. Anyway, that's how this was circulated. And it was something that included ideas from the Mental Research Institute and a lot of the most interesting thinking in brief therapy and family therapy going on in the United States, at least. And so I got interested in that, and I became interested in Steve and Insoo's work that way. And I had a boyfriend, and his name was Charlie Johnson, and he subscribed to the Underground Railroad. Eventually, I moved from New Orleans with Charlie to Denver, Colorado. And Charlie and I were both wanting to go and study at the Milwaukee Brief Therapy Center, and neither one of us wanted to be the person to pick up the phone and call. I was really the shyest person, but we flipped a coin, and I thought that Charlie would probably lose and have to call, but I had to call. And so I telephoned, and I expected to get the secretary there. And I got Steve DeShazer, whose first book I had already read, and I was just in awe. And I started stammering, and I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Mr. DeShazer, but I'm just so shy, and I'm sort of tongue-tied. And little did I know that I was probably speaking to the shyest person I would ever meet. The two of us were both very, very shy. And I can't even remember what happened next on the phone because I was so nervous. But by the time the conversation was over, Steve had invited Charlie and I to come and spend the weekend at their house. And then during the week to observe and spend time at the Milwaukee Brief Therapy Center. And I said, well, you know, what should we pay? And he said, oh, it'll cost you. And I said, well, you know, just we want to be prepared. And he said, oh, you'll be able to afford it, you know. So the next thing we knew, we were in Milwaukee, and we were just so impressed with both Steve and Insoo and their colleagues, Eve Lipchick, Gail Miller. I think Michelle Wiener Davis was probably still there. Just wonderful people, Elam Nunnally, and there's more people whose names I can't remember, but I remember it just as being this intellectually stimulating yet soulful street front clinic where they saw virtually anybody who came in, and they might see homeless heroin addicts who were just trying to find their way, or they might see the family of a local professor, people from every walk of life in all the sessions were recorded so that afterwards, and this was with, of course, the client's permission, so that afterwards the staff at the Milwaukee Brief Therapy Center could review them, listen to the tape, and record anything that was done or said by the therapist or the client that led to positive change. And this was very radical because most American approaches were developed in ivory tower university communities. And I don't mean to slight those. I'm married to a professor. But they were developed by experimenting with what helped really high-achieving students, really rather privileged people, in my view. And so the Milwaukee Brief Family Therapy Center was focusing on a true community, a clinical population of people who represented, I think, a wider population. So I immediately had a lot of respect. And it was a somewhat traumatic experience for me, too, because after a day, Stephen Insoom, they threw me on the team. And I said, oh, I'm not ready. They said, yes, you are. And that was the beginning of a pattern. And I remember one time I was teaching a workshop. I guess I'd written another book by then. I was teaching a workshop. And Steve told me afterwards that it had been a good workshop. And I said, oh, I didn't know you were there. And he said, I know. I've learned to hide from you because I make you too nervous. He said to me, and I'll never forget this because it made a difference in my life. He said, Yvonne, you know a lot more than you know you know. And I thought, you know, I'm going to save that. And I'm going to say that to other people when it's true about them. And I have. You know a lot more than you know you know. And I like to say that to my students, but only when it's true. I think that in solution-focused approach, one of the things that's very important is to be accurate and truthful.
Mm-hmm. So you just shared that you went to see Stephen Insoom and they threw you in and... And then you came back to Denver, I guess. So how did this experience change your work? And, well, what differences did it make for you?
Well, you know, a few months later, Charlie Johnson and I got married. And I don't think that was because of Stephen Insoom. But I think that part of it was due to the fact that we had so much in common that we had learned from them, that we came back to Denver and started a solution-focused team, which endured, I suppose, for about 20 years. And so that was a big influence. And Stephen Insoom started regularly visiting, sometimes every month, sometimes every couple months. And I, by then, had some consultation jobs and at different social service agencies. Often these were teams that were treating incest. They were treating child abuse problems. They were working with very troubled families. And when I was having trouble applying the solution-focused approach, I would just bring Stephen Insoom with me. And I learned so much from what they said. And I learned so much from asking them to help me understand. So that was really a rich and beautiful experience. And in between, we did a lot of hiking, all of us in the mountains. Those were wonderful years.
It seemed to be not only a professional partnership, but also a very true friendship that emerged out of that.
Yes, I felt very, very lucky. Matthias Varga von Kibbid, I don't know if you know his work. He was another good friend of Steve's. I said how lucky I had felt to have been mentored by Steve. And Matthias said, well, you know, Yvonne, these things are two-way streets. It was a mutual relationship. And I guess it was. And Insoom was also a very dear friend. We were more girlfriends. We traveled through Asia together. We would meet up in Europe. I would usually meet Steve in the United States and Europe, and I would usually see Insoom more at conferences and if we were working together in Asia. And they were different relationships. Steve often helped me understand how Wittgenstein, for example, he was a Wittgensteinian scholar, how Wittgenstein applies to solution-focused approach, how it informs the approach. Insoom and I would talk more pragmatically about clients usually.
I love the just the different qualities, and I think the different qualities of all three of you then bringing out even greater things and just using what emerges in interactions and in the in-between is such a precious thing. And just as Matthias said to you, it's like mutual, and I think every encounter brings a unique possibility in bringing out something great if we want to have it. So
yeah.
I'm very grateful for our conversation right now, bringing out all these wonderful things.
And one of those mutual results is the book Modern Miracles with Steve DeShazer and Yvonne Dolan that has influenced so many people around the world, also us. And you also mentioned that you are known for solution focus and trauma, and now have an interest in solution focus and everyday life. So what have you discovered there that makes a difference?
Well, this is an odd way to explain it, but in college, I had a double major, and one of my majors was philosophy. And I was always fascinated with the question of how to live. How to live in a meaningful and rewarding way. So the solution-focused approach, I think, has the possibility of providing a map for people. I have this wonderful stepson, and when he was a teenager, he's 29 now, but when he was a teenager, he used to tell me that if he was struggling with something, he found it helpful, whatever it was, whether it was emotional or some dilemma. You know, you have a lot of dilemmas when you're in your teens and 20s. He found it helpful to put it on a scale, because then he could always see whether an action would make something better, worse, or maintain it. And I think that this wonderful fluidity provided by a scale is something that helps people do critical thinking in a way that can still be soulful, because it doesn't exclude the emotions. It simply allows one to look at the large picture. So I'm fascinated by that sort of idea of how to use a solution-focused approach to inform a meaningful life.
And you as leading a solution-focused lifestyle, how does that show in your life, in your partnership with Terry Trapper? And yeah, and I mean, just seeing the two of you and meeting you gives a sense that there is something good going on.
Well, I knew of Terry's work long before I met him. I met Terry in 2000, but I had known his work because I had been working with families and also with survivors of sexual abuse. And he had written a very excellent book with Mary Jo Barrett on a systemic approach to the treatment of incest. There was one sentence in his book that has stood out for me years before when I was doing my own writing about the solution-focused approach with that population. And the statement was, no matter how terrible the trauma or abuse was, it was not the client's only life experience. If we behave with our clients as if the trauma was the only significant life experience, they become the victim of our therapy as well as the abuse. And I thought, wow, that is such a succinct way of looking at this. The solution-focused approach allows us to identify things that can counterbalance the difficult or painful or bad things that happen in life. And in that sense, it creates a lens where we can say, okay, this or this happened, but what else happened that might be also useful to consider or to replicate or to embrace? So I think that the solution-focused approach to trauma can be understood in some ways as an approach of counterbalance and of coping. And it also is an approach that, when done well, provides compassion, both self-compassion and compassion on the part of the therapist or coach towards the person who has experienced something difficult. Even if you're solution focused, they rarely come to see us and say, I'm having a really good time in life or at work or in my relationships. I just thought I'd come in and talk it over because it's going so well.
Even though this would be the best time yes. to come.
Usually they come in because they're wrestling with something or longing for something to be different. And I think the solution-focused approach helps them find a map, helps us find a map to help that person. It also provides a counterbalance, because traumatic experiences, whether they're trauma or other difficult life experiences that are not trauma, often are so powerful in the moment that they can give us amnesia for all the things that we most need. I mean, it's a little piece of hell in the human condition that the times when people most need to remember their strengths and resources and friends and personal wisdom are the times when they're most likely to have amnesia for it, because they're in the grip of a painful life experience. And the solution-focused approach, particularly with scaling and particularly with questions about exceptions, allows people to see the larger map and allows them to get out of that hole they might temporarily find themselves in just by knowing it's there. And I find that so meaningful about this approach.
Yes.
Yeah. So I met Terry as a result of knowing about his writing. That's how I happened to meet him.
And then you got into this relationship.
Oh, yes.
I would love to come back again to the solution-focused lifestyle. And I would love to hear some recipes, ideas from you. how you can apply solution focus in your lifestyle.
Yeah. Well,
how you do it.
You know, in terms of my relationship with Terry, I guess I'll say what Stephen Insu used to say about theirs. Whenever anyone would ask, they would say, well, we met, and we were attracted to each other, and one thing led to another. And that's what I'll say about Terry. But I actually met Terry at an international therapy conference in Norway.
Oh, you also met at a therapy
conference. Yes, yes, yes. All I can say is be careful.
Yeah, we
be
agree.
Careful. I always tell people, be careful who you spend time with at conferences.
We
it's worked
that,
out very well for all of us, so I feel very lucky.
It's great to have such great role models, by the way.
Well, at least we're happy, you know. In terms of a recipe, when I look at the solution-focused approach with difficult life experiences, because, you know, often in coping with difficult experiences, we build parts of our life that become the most rewarding parts. And I believe that the solution-focused approach can be summarized in regards to trauma and difficult life experiences as a three-pronged approach. Compassion is very important, that solution-focused therapists don't lose sight of that connection of compassion. But the second one is counterbalance. You know, what are the other things going on? What are the exceptions? What are the times when things are even a little bit better? How would you recognize that you had gone up a point on the scale? Those sorts of things. And the other one is coping. And not much is usually said or written about solution-focused coping questions. But in terms of everyday life, I think they're so important. I used to teach once a year at Denver University in a nursing program with some colleagues of mine worked there, and a good friend of mine was teaching a course for young psychiatric nurses. And Charlie Johnson and I would each come in at different times of the year and teach a little bit about solution focused. Well, there was a young nurse student who had just learned about the miracle question. And she was doing a rotation as a student working for a oncologist in a cancer unit. And the doctors in the United States are really overworked. Perhaps you've noticed that. Sometimes they have to see a seemingly impossible number of patients in an hour. And this young psychiatric nurse was there with the oncologist, who was a surgeon. And he came in, they met with a family, this young nurse, and then there was a young woman about the same age as the nurse. And then there was his parents and her partner. And the young woman who was suffering from cancer was just the same age as this young nursing student. And the oncologist told the family and the patient this very terrible news, that this young woman had only maybe a month, maybe slightly more to live, maybe even less. And then the oncologist, and he said it gently and sensitively, but he really had very little time. And he said, I am so sorry, but I have to leave for the next patient. Turned to the young nurse and said, you talk to them. And so this young nurse, as she told the story to us, was just looking at this family, just racked with pain and anticipated loss. And the patient herself, who was just about the nurse's age, had her hands, you know, on her face, her head in her hands, and she was in shock. And there's this terrible silence that I think therapists experience sometimes when a situation is painful and you're not exactly sure what to say, and you're desperate to say something that's compassionate and that will give some kind of help. And this young nurse cleared her throat, and by now the parents and the partner were all looking at her, and the patients, her head is still in her hands, and she looks at the patient and she says, I'm so sorry, first of all. None of us know how long we have, and this kind of news is just so hard to hear, I'm sure. I'm just so sorry. And she says this in a very heartfelt way. And then there's another terrible silence. You know, and the patient kind of nods, and the family nods, and there's silence, and everyone's looking at the young nurse. Say something to help. Please help. It's an impossible situation. And the nurse thinks, and she thinks, and she said, there's a strange question. Sometimes it helps. And another long pause, and then she said, it takes some imagination, but sometimes it helps. And now the patient takes her hands away from her face, and she looks at the young nurse, and the nurse said to the patient, she said, I know it's really hard to sleep in hospitals. These are noisy places, but let's suppose that tonight somehow you manage to get to sleep, and it's a pretty good sleep. And sometime during the night, something very good happens. Maybe it's an angel, maybe it's a blessing, maybe it's some wisdom you've been storing up inside you. I don't know exactly how it happens, but it's sort of a miracle. Because when you awake in the morning, you find yourself knowing absolutely the best way for you to spend whatever time you have left to you under these circumstances. What would be the first thing that would come to mind? And you wake up and you know that. And there's another terrible silence. And the patient puts her head back in her hands. And the young psychiatric nurse is panicking, but she doesn't say anything. She waits. Because in solution-focused approach, we listen. And after a few more seconds, the patient looks up and she says to the nurse, "I'd get married." And patient looks at the nurse, but then she looks at her partner. And then she looks at the nurse. And she looks at her parents and she looks at her young son, who's there too now. And she says to her partner, "I do it for us. I do it for you." She looks at her parents, "I do it for you." And she said to the little son, "And I do it for you too. But mostly I do it for me." And after that, there were a few weeks that she still had left. And instead of just anticipating her loss, they were spent picking out some music to play at this little wedding that would take place in the hospital and picking out a little dress that could be somehow put on, you know, a nice dress, even though she was in a wheelchair. And even though she was saying goodbye to many people in her mind, she was also saying hello to them one more time at this very joyous experience. And a few weeks later, she and her partner were married. And it turned out her partner had asked her before to get married, but she had not said yes until now. And they got married, and there was a little reception in the nurse's lounge. And I think they bent the hospital rules a little bit. More people were allowed to attend than normal. And there were balloons, and there was a soft, beautiful music. And it was a very meaningful thing, both for the patient and for the family, for everyone else. And I think it could never have happened if this young nurse had not had the courage to ask that. And back then, people used to question whether we should ever use the miracle question in dire circumstances when things were really difficult. And I still think we have to be very careful to be sensitive to that. But that little story from this inexperienced young psychiatric nurse really impressed me. And it's really informed in many ways the way I look at this approach.
And it shows how, even though she, as you say, wasn't experienced, she was able to put the miracle question in a way that was really appropriate for the situation.
Yes. I think the key words there were under the circumstances. And I think there's many ways to ask that kind of question. You know, another way is to say, what would happen if suddenly you woke up and you were a 10? And 10 meant that you were coping with the situation in the best way possible. Or where are you now between 0 and 10? If 10 was the very best you could cope with something and 0 was the opposite. So I think that the solution-focused approach benefits from people having courage. And often new therapists are particularly good at daring to ask people these questions. They're difficult questions to answer. And one of the things I remember from watching Steve and watching Insu over the years is the importance of asking these questions in a way that leaves no doubt that you want to know the answer. And solution-focused questions are so simple, and many of them are sort of formulaic when you first learn them, and it's easy to skip over the importance of asking them in a soulful, heartfelt way. And DeShazer and Berg were both people who didn't use a lot of words. And because of that, they didn't spend a lot of time focusing overtly on the emotional quality of the way they asked those questions, but they embodied it. Now, I have this wonderful colleague who's focusing a lot on the really most essential elements of engaging with someone when you're asking a solution-focused question. That's my colleague, Anne Lutz. But what we're all trying to do, I think, is to teach our students to ask these questions in a way that has heart behind them. And I think that's so important.
Well, I think that really makes a difference. And it's like this connection piece. And the one thing is asking the question. The other thing is the connection we feel in this moment and feeling connected to another person. And then also feeling connected to ourselves. When giving the answers, it allows us to connect in a very different way to our own life with a different focus, with a little shift, with this putting the hope on and invite hope and light into the darkness. And by that, sinking into the light, as Angel Knox put it in our podcast.
Sure. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. Well, hope is a tricky word when people are going through difficult life experiences. Sometimes they can experience the word hope as insulting. Mm. So there's implicit hope and there's explicit hope. And one of the things that I find very useful about the solution-focused approach is asking someone about the future, even if the future is 5 minutes from now, is an implicit hope question. So it's a way to very delicately plant the idea that there is a future.
Wow, there are so many topics that we could go on with. After so many years with solution focus and all those experiences and all those learnings, if there's one thing that you would like our listeners to take away from the podcast and also from your experience that really could make a difference for them because it made a difference for you, what would that be?
I believe that it's very important to always end a solution-focused session with evidence-based compliments based on something that you have heard or observed directly with the client. Over the years, I've done a lot of live sessions with clients in front of groups. And one of the things I've often done is asked all the observers in the group to write down an evidence-based compliment that the clients can read at their leisure. And one of the surprising things I've learned from asking clients what was helpful is they say these compliments made a huge difference. And that's often not necessarily emphasized in trainings, but I think it's very important. They have to be legitimate and real. And I think there's something very healing and encouraging for people to be seen in a benevolent, accurate, and compassionate way by the coach or by the therapist, by the listeners. And so it's something that I think is emphasized in solution-focused approach, but I think that maybe it needs to be even emphasized a little more when we're training people. And particularly if a session ends that way, the client has a little something they can hang on to as they go out of your office that can make a difference.
That's beautiful. And I want to pick that up and thank you for being such a role model in focusing on the brilliance of people instead of gossiping. Because this is one of the things I in our conversation was reminded so beautifully of today, and that the difference it makes to shift our conversations to talk about the brilliance of people. And I had a time when I chose deliberately not to gossip again, and you put it so brilliantly, it's almost like a spiritual practice to do that and really not even to try to enter conversations that allow gossiping. And I think this is such a beautiful way you just live that. And this is for me a very solution-focused lifestyle as well. Just looking at the resources, at the light, at the brilliance, at whatever words you want to use for that. Yeah. So thank you very much for that, Ivan.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's a recipe for happiness, I think.
Yeah.
So let's come to the challenge of the week.
Well, of course, I think that it would be a nice exercise to have your listeners give evidence-based compliments to the people in their life. I say evidence-based because it has to be based on direct observation of something that person has done or said, or I guess it could even be things that they observe. I hear women saying to each other all the time, "I love your shoes." So it could be something as frivolous as some beautiful color someone's wearing, or it could be as heartfelt as saying that you were very touched by something someone said or did. But I think that compliments, sincere compliments, make a huge difference, both for the giver and the receiver. And I think it's a beautiful part of the solution-focused approach that Stephen Insu embodied, but we didn't write as much about. And I think that it's important to preserve.
What a beautiful and very inspiring way to do while we drive up to Taos now. be prepared to some evidence-based compliments today.
Oh, with great pleasure. And thank you very much again for having us here, for sharing your beautiful stories with us. And we are curious to everyone out there listening to us, what inspired you with this podcast? And we're also curious how the Challenge of the Week works for you. So let us know and comment on www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 47.
Thank you again and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This was the Simply Focus podcast with Alfie Cherney and Dominic Odat, your podcast for a life in joy and ease.